Ars Electronica, 2006. Simplicity, the art of complexity.
Also guten Nachmittag zu unserem letzten Beitrag für den heutigen Tag. Es ist mir eine besondere Freude, it is a special pleasure to welcome Jasia Reichardt. There is not very much to introduce about Jasia because we have been seeing her work all through the day already. But maybe it is important to say that she has been doing other things since Cybernetic Serendipity. And she has been a director of the Whitechapel Gallery, and she has been teaching at the Architectural Association and was a prolific curator and writer in many fields beyond cybernetics. And she even told me that after a while she was fed up with Cybernetic Serendipity because that was the main topic that everybody was asking her for. And for sure, life goes on and you're still fresh and active. And 68 is a long time ago. So you will introduce us today something of the more background of the scientific field of Great Britain in the 60s or even in the late 50s maybe, which are linked to this common room, which I never heard about before, I must admit. So your title is Untalked From the Common Room to Cybernetic Serendipity. And I like very much that while discussing what your possible contribution to our panel today could be, your first reaction was you have been giving a couple of talks on cybernetic serendipity and you don't want to repeat yourself. So I like that attitude very much because even if somebody like you is often asked to play the same song again, you try to resist to the tendency to become just a pop star with one hit. And so I'm very curious about the background that brought you and maybe the whole idea of cybernetics and art together in the background of the British community of the time. Thanks a lot. Okay.
Thank you very much indeed. And I'm very happy to be here. And now, if we could just turn off all the lights, because the important thing will be the pictures. Now, in the 20th century, the machine was the future. Long before digital technology changed our lives and cybernetics made its mark, people speculated and agonized about what the machine might or might not be capable of. Today, the future is the matrix. Then it was the machine. And here is the future from the 1920s. This detailed drawing is entitled A Quiet Lunch at Home by A.M. Lowe. Not one machine, but a whole environment. And I don't know what the food is like. And this is just a diagram, a somewhat romantic one. It's a favorite of mine, Titus Chizhevsky's Mechanical Garden of 1920 is both a poem and a map. Now the machine, or rather the computer in all its forms, is the present. When it comes to history of the connections between art and technology, there are two strands we must look at. The first has to do with aesthetics, the second has to do with ideas. The first strand demonstrates a common aesthetic that belongs to a period and its products, whatever they are. The forms that are prevalent and persistent for a time, perhaps 5 to 10 years, become the essence of style. We can date paintings and machines by them because they are what machines, design, and art share. On the left is the Hannibal Ford combined bomb sight and electromechanical computer of 1918. On the other side is Moholy-Nage's typographical painting of 1921, spelling his name. On the left, a 1923 gyropilot installed on the steamship Munargo, and on the right, Parade Amoureuse by Picabia. Picabia adapts available forms from contemporary technology and romanticizes them. And this image is 50 years later, 1970. It is the Apollo 11 spaceship. Its form could be a sculpture and is certainly reminiscent of several types of artists' constructions of the time, including this cybernetic sculpture by Edward Ignatovich called Senster of the same year. Forms of the common aesthetic are part of a moving man-made landscape with both the artists and the engineers traveling on the same train. Now I come to the second strand, ideas. Before any artist thought of any given technology as a gateway towards new art, the scientists thought of it first. And when it comes to computers, the scientists were the first computer artists. A significant name here is that of Alan Turing, of course. On the left is his celebrated diagram of the Universal Turing Machine of 1936. It is a device for manipulating symbols that can be adapted to simulate the logic of any computer that could possibly be constructed. In 1949, Turing was working at the University in Manchester in the Department of Electrotechnics together with M.H.A. Newman. They were working on the Manchester University computer built by Professor F.C. Williams, and this is the computer. An article about the Manchester University computer, which you see on the left, appeared in the Times newspaper entitled The Mechanical Brain. Its appearance is somewhat unprepossessing. It is composed of racks of electrical apparatus consisting of a mass of untidy wires, valves, chassis, and display tubes. When in action, the cathode ray becomes a pattern of dots which shows what information is in the machine. Mr. Turing said yesterday, "This is only a foretaste of what is to come and only the shadow of what is going to be. We have to have some experience with the machine before we really know its capabilities, but I do not see why it should not enter any of the fields normally covered by the human intellect and eventually compete on equal terms." "I do not think," he continued, "you can even draw the line about sonnets. Thought perhaps the comparison is a little bit unfair because a sonnet written by a machine would be better appreciated by another machine. The university," the article continued, "was interested in the investigation of the possibilities of machines for their own sake." And indeed, soon enough, computers did produce poems. Some years later, texts and poems came from computers in Europe and America. Here's a haiku from Cambridge Language Research Unit. And here's another. Both were shown at Cybernetic Serendipity Exhibition in 1968. In the 1950s, however, artists and scientists still occupied separate domains. Alan Turing's idea about machines competing with human intellect were the exception. However, during the 1950s, there was a place in London where these ideas were discussed. It was the Gabber Bocuse Common Room. The common room occupied the basement of Gabbabocco's press and was open on Thursday evenings and later on Tuesday evenings as well. Look at the bottom two lines on this card. The common room was there to provide opportunities for the scientific and artistic attitudes to meet. Gabbabocco's, which is the Latinization of Jabberwocky in Alice in Wonderland, was the biggest of the small presses in London after the Second World War. It was founded by Franziska and Stefan Temerson in 1948 and was run by them until 1979. Stefan Temerson was a writer. Franziska Temerson was a painter. She was also, incidentally, the designer of Cybernetic Serendipity. The Temersons made abstract films in Poland during the 1930s. Then they lived in Paris, but in the early 1940s they were in London and made two more experimental films. When they could not find support for any more films, they decided to start a publishing company, Gabbabocco's Press, which would publish bestlookers rather than bestsellers. The common room was a modest basement. It was a place where those interested in the arts and the sciences could meet, see films, listen to talks, read journals, look at displays on the walls, eat spaghetti and drink wine. The aim of this common room was to provide artists and scientists and people interested in both the philosophy of science and the philosophy of art with a congenial place where they could meet and exchange thoughts. The common room was active 1957 to 1959. And it was there during those 2 years that the members were introduced to various sorts of thinking about different subjects, to pop art before it arrived on the scene in the United Kingdom, to cybernetics, to music concrète, and above all, to the various possibilities of things being interconnected. Another view. Oswald Blakeston, a Gabbabocco's author, called it the uncommon room and wrote about the subjects that were discussed there as follows. Artists and today's scientists go to nature to discover how things are put together. And having discovered this, they make things which nature could never have made. In all, there were 83 evenings of lectures, discussions, performances, films, music held in Gabbabocco's common room between August 1957 and the summer of 1959. Then the common room closed for the summer and never reopened. Now, this is the original program for the first 12 evenings. I really do hope you'll be able to just read the titles of the evening events, and you can see that they were all about the connections between art, literature, music, and science. I will leave you for 1 minute just to read this. Well, it was there that I first came across cybernetics. Zed Tarkovsky, an industrial psychologist, introduced cybernetics as a study of control, also referred to as homeostasis, and or the theory of communication. He gave examples, explained feedback mechanism, circular causality applicable in physics, in engineering, in mathematics, in physiology and psychology. He pointed out how sometimes common sense fails us, both in dealing with cybernetic devices, such as a fridge, and similarly in dealing with people. If evenings at the common room opened doors to unexpected possibilities. One person whom I came into contact with during that time was Irving John Good, a mathematician who, in 1962, edited a book called The Scientist Speculates. Among the contributors writing about the future possibilities were some of the best-known scientists of the day. Many of the names would be familiar to you today. Norbert Wiener, Ludwig Wittgenstein, J.A. Wheeler, Marvin Minsky, Colin Cherry, Turing. The subjects covered included information theory, cybernetics, language, computers, physics, biology, space, and so on. Among the articles in this book was one on music color by Gordon Pask. Devised in 1954, of course you know all about it by now, having heard Margit a little earlier on. It was, of course, a system demonstrating possibilities of cooperation between human and machine. It consisted of 6 projectors, a rack of electronic equipment, and servo mechanisms for mechanical control. The machine produced changing patterns of shapes and color in response to music played by the operator. The operator could modify the output until a satisfactory result was arrived at. It was a learning system for both the operator and the machine. Pask wrote about it as follows. In judging the performance of the device, the operator and the machine must be regarded as a single system, as is shown in the diagram. Experiments with over 50 performers indicate not only that the operator eventually obtains a better performance than he did initially, which would in itself simply mean that he has learned to operate the device as one learns to play any musical instrument, and also that the device learns as well. Later, of course, there was another cybernetic machine, which of course by now you also know very well, the Colloquy of Mobiles, which was shown at Cybernetic Serendipity. And the Colloquy is, of course, much more complicated than music color. It consisted of 5 figures featuring a dialogue between 2 male and 3 female forms. The males are in the center, the bulbous females, designed by Yolanda Sonnabend. You can only see 2 of them here, are outside. They communicated with one another, competing and cooperating. The complex interaction was affected by sounds as well as by projected lights from the males and reflected lights from the females. The audience could also participate in the game once they understood the colloquy's goals and frustrations. The strategies involving beams of orange light, sounds and reflections were difficult enough to understand in ideal circumstances, in an exhibition where other machines were also dependent for their activities on colored lights and sounds, it became almost impossible to understand the complicated interactions. And so this is one of the routes which leads to cybernetic serendipity. But there was also another. In 1965, I organized at the ICA an exhibition of concrete poetry. It was called Between Poetry and Painting. Professor Max Benzer, whom you have already seen in action this morning, the philosopher, concrete poet, and scientist, came to London from Stuttgart to see this exhibition. We met on several occasions, and he asked me at one point what I was going to do next. As I didn't know, he suggested that I should look into computers. And so I did. And one of the first sources I went to was, of course, computers and automation. And many of the contributors to Cybernetic Serendipity were found in the pages of that journal including Bella Ulis, Michael Knoll, Frieda Nacke, and Georg Nays. The works for Cybernetic Serendipity came principally from true streams. One stream belonged to the artists who made sculptures that moved, performed, interacted. The other stream consisted of computer graphics and animations which were made by engineers and scientists. I simplify, of course, because there were also computer-composed and generated music, history of cybernetics and computers, various other sculptures and objects that were neither made by artists nor based on the uses of computers. Cybernetic Serendipity was like a railway station, a junction at which people arrived at from different directions. They didn't know each other, and they didn't know about each other. There was one element that was relevant to most of the works, and that was chance or randomness. Computers and Automation was founded in 1950 by Edmund C. Barclay. It was the first computer periodical. In 1963, Computers and Automation initiated an annual competition for visually interesting computer graphics. Usually, the competition took place in August, but this was the cover of the January issue of 1963. This image was produced at MIT by feeding images from a TV camera to a computer and controlling the representation of the data on an oscilloscope. But by August the same year, there was the first winner of the annual competition. It was Frieda Nacke, with a star pattern of which, unfortunately, I don't have a picture. And now I will show you very quickly some of the covers and pages from Computers and Automation, and you will see many of the images that are now so familiar. Most of them come from Germany and from America. The 1965 winner was Michael A. Knoll with this Mondrian pattern, or rather, I should say, his Mondrian pattern. He argued that his image was more popular than the original plus and minus picture of 1917 by Mondrian on which it was based. And here it is with the original Mondrian on the right. Frieda Nacke won the contest for the second time in 1966 with this pattern of uniform small squares. And this is a double page spread from the same issue. On the right, Peter Milojevich and D.K. Robbins, and on the left, two more images by Nacke. In 1967, the winners of the competition were Charles Tsuri and James Schaffer with this sine curve man. Cover of the 1968 issue. The winners are Gary Craigmile and Kerry Strand with this hummingbird. Now, this issue was bigger, probably because Cybernetic Serendipity exhibition opened at the same time and many more works became available. Some of these images appeared in the magazine before, but here for the first time you see the work of the Computer Technique Group of Tokyo. You see the transformation of Kennedy and Marilyn Monroe, and on the right, Return to the Square, which is at the top. And also in this issue, as you can see, there was color. So that was August 1968. Now, how are we doing for time, please?
Go ahead.
Okay. Now I want to tell you a bit about Cybernetic Serendipity. And here is the first announcement of the exhibition. Preparation took 3 years. When the project was first launched, the ICA had a gallery on the first floor of number 17 Dover Street in central London. There were also very tiny offices on the other side of the street. And at the time, the ICA employed only 5 people, and that included a secretary, an accountant, and so on. By the time the exhibition opened in August 1968, there were new premises in the mall and a huge gallery. There were four people principally involved with the exhibition, but in the end, there were about 50 people working on it. Top right is Peter Schmidt, music consultant. Bottom left is Mark Dawson, technical consultant. Bottom right is Franziska Temerson, designer of the exhibition and of all the printed material. This is her poster, using images from the works exhibited. The text was typed on a typewriter. On the right is the list of 16 lectures which took place during the exhibition. None of them were recorded. ICA had no recording equipment. Among the speakers were Yanis Zanakis, Abraham Moles, Gordon Pask, Frank Malina. The text on the left of the poster elucidates the title, Cybernetic Serendipity. S. The faculty of making happy chance discoveries by means of control and communication machines, both human and electronic. And then, further down, an exhibition demonstrating how man can use the computer and new technology to extend the scope of his creativity and inventiveness, and where basic questions such as what is cybernetics and how computers work are answered. There was no catalogue as such, but this was the publication of the exhibition, a special issue of Studio International. There was also a long-playing record called Cybernetic Serendipity Music, which included most of the music people could listen to during the exhibition. Two invitations to the exhibition. The text on the other side of one at the top reads, "You are invited to celebrate the auspicious encounter of cybernetics and art." The party was on the 1st of August from 9 till 12. And the opening speech was made by Anthony Wedgwood Benn, who was then the Minister of Technology. The card at the bottom was to the private view the following day. And here are the admission tickets to the exhibition, lectures and films. Two more admission tickets. This is the model of the exhibition. If you look at the image at the top, the entrance is from the right, and the black section on the left is the film viewing area. The image at the bottom is a bit more difficult to read. When visitors entered the exhibition, the first thing they saw was a digitized portrait of Norbert Wiener. Perhaps the portrait of Claude Shannon should have been there too. I always felt a bit bad about that. And so finally, here he is, photographed in 1949 with his maze-solving mouse to study telephone switching systems. The second thing people would have seen had they looked down as they walked down the steps leading into the exhibition, was this color mosaic by Frieda Nacker, which was projected onto a square of white tiles on the floor. And here's a selection of graphics from the exhibition. Two classic images, both by Georg Nase, Corridor and on the right, Curtain. This image was unintended, as he told me, discovered by chance, thrown up by the computer while he was working on something else. Charles Turi produced a whole suite of circle-to-square transformations using the Vitruvian Man. Computer Technique Group from Japan contributed a number of graphics in several groups. Monroe in the Net belongs to a group they call Deformations. The program is by Haruki Tsuchiya. Kennedy in a dog with the data from a photograph of Kennedy inserted into data from a photograph of a dog is from an idea by Masao Komura, programmed by Fujio Niwa. One of my favorites is Running Cola is Africa, from a series called Metamorphosis. The term morphing was not used at the time. And here, surprise, surprise, is Masao Komura talking about Running Cola is Africa to students at Chukyo University earlier this year. But back to the 60s, here are members of the Computer Technique Group of Tokyo in 1968. I learned recently that there were only two computer printers of that size in Japan at the time. The group had managed to persuade IBM to allow them to use one of them. View of the exhibition. In front, you see SAM, sound-activated mobile by Edward Ignatovich. Another view of more or less the same area. Hanging from the ceiling is Scanner by James Seawright. And in the center, there is a demonstration computer for booking airline tickets. Cybernetic serendipity with visitors. You can see people trying to communicate with SAM in the foreground. SAM was a sound-activated mobile sculpture by Ignatovich, and it was an electro-hydraulic structure sensitive to sounds in their environment. When people talked to it quietly, it would bend its flower-like head towards them as if to listen. Children were very good at modulating their voices, but adults tended to be embarrassed and talked too loud for some to respond. And this is the creator of SAM, Edward Ignatovich, 2 years later, with his new sculpture, Senster, more complicated than SAM, but based on similar principle. The sculpture was commissioned by Philips and for some time was displayed at the Avaluen in Eindhoven. It looked like a giant imaginary giraffe. It too responded to sounds and would move towards the sound of a voice. Different sounds elicited different movements. The sculpture turned out to be too popular. Children played truant from school, and people organized their marriage ceremonies in front of it. Unfortunately, at some point, Philips decided that they'd had enough. The sculpture was dismantled, and to my knowledge, most of the pieces were lost. Now, at the end of my talk, there's a video, and you'll be able to see it in operation. Back to the exhibition, Two Robots by Bruce Lacey. This is a better view. Rosa Bosom is on the right. She had very large lips on an extendable arm and would thrust them at the visitors. It was very off-putting, I believe. History of Cybernetics section was compiled by Morris Trusk of IBM. Afterwards, it was published as a book. Cybernetic sculpture by Wenying Tsai. The steel rods vibrate in constant harmonic motion, but sounds such as clapping altered the frequency of the strobe flash, which made the rods appear to undulate. On the other side was the Tingeli painting machine of 1959. On the right, you can just see the very thin vertical object made of laminated wood. It is a computer-generated sculpture by Robert Mallory. And here is the Tingeli machine. And with one of the paintings it produced on the right. Now, when Tingeli was in London, he signed the drawings while he was there. present while the machine was making them. And so this is how you see the signature. There were also other drawing machines, including several harmonographs. This was one of them by John Revillius. The special property of this drawing machine was that once a random pattern was satisfactory, it could be repeated. And here is another one and the sort of drawing it produced. Each machine had to have an attendant to supply paper and inks. This is why I said 50 people had to work on the exhibition. In the center, on the slide on the left, on a stand is the recreation of the Raymond Lull logic machine and the Namjoon Paik's robot. And on the right is the top of the logic machine. And here you have better views of the Namjoon Paik robot. And you can also see on the left a red painting of a microcircuit by Ulla Wiggen. A child's drawing of a mechanical boy and a robot by John Billingsley called Albert. And the main action of this robot was to turn his head. In those days, we thought it was pretty good. And here we approach the section with the computer poems and texts. The work on the right is Ken Cox's kinetic sculpture composed of letters cut out of sheets of metal. It was called Amor, Voluptas, Pulcritudo, and these three words or elements were in constant rotation and interacted with each other at random, producing different sorts of word combinations. And this is another part of the section of computer poems and texts. And here are stills from one of the films that was shown in the cinema section. And this is what the cinema section looked like. The seating was based on cubes and could be disassembled in 1 hour. They were painted gray and looked just like a dramatic constructivist sculpture. A view of the graphics section. Many of them were accompanied by their programs. Some were in the size and on paper that emerged from the plotter. These were on the display units with hinged panels. Others were enlarged and shown on the walls. And here is another view. And here once more for the third time today, the colloquy of mobiles. And in this image, you can see all the three female figures, and CISP is in the background on the right. Now, Nicholas Schoeffer's 1967 sculpture, which was a later version of CISP, moved around on rollers, became excited by silence and the color blue. And it was calmed by noise and the color red. When excited, it moved forward, retreated, made a quick turn, and its plates started turning very fast. Since all the machines in cybernetic serendipity were responding to each other's movements and sounds, it was enormously difficult to control the exhibits. This sculpture had to have a special attendant, of course. Its activities kept on interfering with the colloquy of mobiles. Some people referred to this unplanned interaction as machine communication. Others referred to it as misunderstandings. Two slightly different views of the exhibition, which included the music section and the five music spheres, of which one was black. Another view. On the left, you see a series of music scores. And here is one of the spheres in which people could listen to computer-composed and played music. Each sphere had a different selection of compositions. On the way out of the exhibition, you see Nam June Paik's transformed television images. The shining, sparkling sculpture in the distance is the Hanuel Emmet forget-me-not computer. The drawing gives you a better idea of what it looked like. The forget-me-not computer by the artist and engineer Roland Emmet was a busy, noisy, gothic, surrealist automaton whose sole purpose was to entertain. Now, this typeface, which avoids curves and diagonals, was developed at the National Physical Laboratory and was used for two issues of the ICA magazine with contents related to the exhibition. And here are the two covers of the first issue with Lowell Nesbitt computer painting. And these are the covers of the second issue, which quote reviews and offer handwritten notes about the show. One of the quotations from the evening news was, "The Industrial Revolution produced the machine age. With the computer comes the machine age art." After Cybernetic Serendipity closed in October 1968, interest in art involving technology seemed to wane for some time. As media art gradually spread its wings, it took about 30 years before young artists working with computers wanted to know about cybernetic serendipity and how it all started. And that's all, ladies and gentlemen. I think I've finished more or less on time. Thank you. How late? I'm very late.
Perfect. It's absolutely perfect. So thanks for this wonderful talk, which included really some background information on this common room that I think nobody has ever been considering in the context of cybernetic serendipity, and which I found very interesting also in linking back to the story about Benze,
yes,
that he was not the only source, but that there is a kind of specific British source also. Is that here? Okay. I have a very banal question just to start with. How many computers were working in cybernetic serendipity? You have to talk a little bit.
Yes. I am thinking two.
Two.
Yes, they were from IBM, and they were just models.
So the IBM machine was the one for selling airplane tickets?
It was a model for computers
selling airplane tickets.
That's
which was
right.
Not on the market yet. So that was one computer, yes, which wasn't one. And the other one was?
There was PASC.
PASC. He included a computer in the piece itself.
Well, of course, because it wouldn't have worked otherwise.
Okay.
So
I think that is a very important information that most people maybe don't have in their awareness, that it was an exhibition about computers, but it didn't really include computers. But it was really an art show thinking about what computers can do or will do in the future before the age of the computer was really entering their operability for most of the artists. So that is very important, I think, to consider, and which is often neglected in talking about cybernetic serendipity.
I would like to add something. There was a music computer for a short time. The composer Peter Zinoviev had a computer for producing music, but unfortunately he couldn't do without it. This was his studio, so he brought it in for a couple of weeks and then he removed it, and this is why I didn't have a picture of it. And how it how people could interact with it was that you could whistle a tune into a microphone, or you could say something, and the computer would translate it into musical or sounds, something of that sort.
Yes, and then the second question we have been discussing already, and then we can open up for the public. There have been various ideas, proposals, attempts that this show should be reconstructed 30 years after. And you were kind of reluctant to those ideas. Maybe you can argue a little bit why.
Well, you have a good quotation.
Yeah, you gave me a quotation yesterday, so maybe I'm you allowed know. To say that. Well, Yasia, yesterday when we had dinner, said, well, it was the first time ever that artists were involved with the idea of the computer. So it is a little bit like being a virgin, and you won't be able to reconstruct that.
That's true.
So
you can only be a virgin once.
You can never be a virgin again. Okay.
Yes.
But maybe there were... I think there's a wonderful reason, and I'm absolutely convinced that it's true in both sides, about the show and about the rest also.
Yes.
But also, you said about the 50 people working there and living there, as far
yes.
as you remember.
Yes.
So this is something which has a spirit of an event more than a show, rather on.
Yes. We didn't use the term event because that wasn't used. There was no... The language was different. I mean, nobody talked, for instance, about artist performance.
Mm.
That didn't exist either. There was no morphing. But I will tell you, I mentioned about 50 people because it was very exciting. And there would be students from the Imperial College of Science volunteering to come. I mean, Tsai had an assistant to look after his machine. Of course, Pask had several people. We also had a technical advisor. It was Mark Dawson, who used to work with Pask in systems research previously. There were a lot of people with experience of sophisticated equipment that were longing somehow to get involved with the scene. And it was the scene then. And of course, everything was breaking down all the time, and everything had to be mended. And it was all being mended at night. And by 10 o'clock, when ICA would open, everything was working again. And it was the only exhibition, in my experience, at the ICA for which there were queues around the block. Because it somehow interested children, and it interested people who were involved with all sorts of subjects.
Yes, but I think you're absolutely right that this kind of spirit of the time is not reconstructible. So everything we would do today would be completely different
yes.
from the feeling you have.
Yes,
here.
It would be... I was trying to think, what would be so new today that it would bring a lot of people who had never collaborated or thought about each other or talked together to do something. And I can't think of anything particularly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe the idea of newness itself has suffered a little
yes,
recently. Yeah, but I understand also that maybe among these people working and living in the exhibition, there was a lot of social interaction. We also learned that there was an interaction involuntary between the exhibits.
Yes.
So I wonder what Schaeffer's piece and Pask's piece might have been talking to each other. But it might be as interesting what the people working in the exhibition were sharing as an experience. Are there any records of that?
I don't know. There might be some, but I'm simply not aware of it. But I am sure that if one asked on the internet for people's experiences of the exhibition, I think one would find some material.
I think that would be a great topic to do.
Definitely.
Because it would add to what we know about the pieces, the other side of the experience that people made. And,
yes.
I think to add one more reason why it is difficult or impossible to reconstruct it, that the experience that people would made regarding certain pieces in 1968 was that of a complete newness and of a really thrilling experience of having something moving according to their interaction, which today this experience of a young generation or even of the same generation would not be longer around, because yes. we are getting much more used after 40 years of this experience of interacting with machines, which was new at the time, but which is now part of our daily life. So that is a factor, I think, that any kind of desire to reconstruct the machine has to be considering, that not only the pieces might be changing, but that we are changing and
our
lifestyle is changing.
I would just like to add something, if I may.
Sure.
Now, when I talked about Gabobaku's common room, what is interesting about the common room, it didn't belong to a university. It didn't belong to a scientific association. It was something that was organized by two people who were interested in the avant-garde and who had broad interests. And they were asked very often, well, what have artists and scientists in common? And I remember Stefan Temerson would say, well, they live in the same world. And they breathe the same air, they eat the same food, and so they are influenced by the same sort of things. And that environment is what must produce some kind of communality. That's
sounds right, a lot I've so finished. Far. So maybe that was our little chat, and but we don't want to exclude the other part of the public, although it's a little bit darker than usually. Can we put up the lights in the room also a little? It would be nice. Thanks. Still the chance to add on what we have been talking here. Or to have a look at the Danube outside. Yeah, any propositions for what could be new today, if the newness is still around with us? Yeah, and we can talk about that afterwards. Which films did you bring?
Yes. Well, first of all, I brought one video, which I think is a perfect example of morphing, by a Japanese artist called Daisuke Furuika, and this is a loop, which I think is quite extraordinary, because what he has used is material that we all know from classical paintings, but what we discover through it are the stages in between which we could never imagine. So that's one thing. That has nothing to do with cybernetic serendipity. But the other thing that I also brought was some films that were shown at Cybernetic Serendipity and Sensta by Edward Ignatovich. So we will have one after another?
Yes.
If maybe that's all right?
Maybe we start with the ones that are closer to Cybernetic Serendipity and go on with the other ones?
As you wish, yes.
Yeah. What is the total running time about, that so people can...
You can stop it at any time. You decide when you want to stop, we can stop.
But what would be the total running time if we...
20 minutes.
20 minutes for the whole thing, yeah. That's perfect. Yes.
Is it fabulous?
Okay, that's fabulous. Okay, great. Okay, thanks a lot.
Okay. Thank you. It was my pleasure.
We can go downstairs while
yes, we can.
You want some water? You have some?
Where was
it? This was yours. Okay. Before we start the films, I think this will be my last intervention, because after the films there is not very much left to say. I would like to say a great thank you to the two translators who have been working hard and invisibly in their boxes. And I think some of us gave them a hard job. Okay, give them a hand. Okay.
Of cybernetic sculpture commissioned by Philips in 1968 for the permanent exhibition The Evolution in Eindhoven in Holland. It was designed to respond to movements and noises made by people around it by moving towards them. The sounds were detected by means of four microphones seen here in the middle of the head, which were continuously seeking out the loudest noises. The movements of these microphones were used in turn to determine the motion of the subsequent joints. The complex acoustics of the hall made its behavior somewhat unpredictable, and some persistence was required to attract the sensor's attention. Transducers, the golden horns on either side of the microphones. The design of the neck of the sensor was in fact based on that of a leg of a lobster. The movements were controlled by a digital computer and affected by a series of six electrohydraulic servo systems, reducing in size along the neck and ending with two extra servos reserved specifically for the control of the four microphones. This is an earlier piece called Sam, built in 1968 using a similar arrangement of four microphones, but otherwise much less sophisticated. Sam was not computerized at all, and its movements were not controlled by proper servo systems either. The neck was constructed out of eight aluminium castings, a bit like vertebrae, and the motions were produced by a set of 16 minute hydraulic pistons situated within the castings themselves. Some were shown at the exhibition called Cybernetic Serendipity, held at the Institute of Contemporary Art in London in 1968.